All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? What the fucknicks? Out in the streets. Fighting the good fight. Thank you for doing that. It's fucking scary, crazy, righteous, chaotic, out of control, focused. A lot of things going on at once. And I tend to be, at this point, somewhat paralyzed with grief and trying to compartmentalize. I don't want to be at the guy at the protest crying about his own problems. But I will throw some ideas out there for you in this time of righteous indignation, peaceful protesting, fury. A few places where you can kick in a few shekels, contribute a few dollars to show your support. These are places that make a difference. Black Voters Matter Fund. They work directly and successfully on increasing the political power of black communities through voter registration and engagement on the local level, not just during presidential elections. That's blackvotersmatterfund.org. NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Police reform and racial justice efforts need litigation and advocacy to be successful. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund, NAACPLDF, NAACPLDF.org. And of course, the ACLU will continue to be helpful for maintaining the First Amendment rights of protesters and fighting legal challenges in court. It's a charity I support yearly. ACLU.org is where you can go to do that. So I'm still, before I get too far, look, with things coming undone at the seams, I don't really know what you people want to listen to or what is relevant to you. But today, my guest is G.E. Smith, who is the former band leader on Saturday Night Live. He's also been the guitarist for Bob Dylan, David Bowie, Roger Waters, Tina Turner, among many others. He's got a record coming out in August called Stony Hill. It's a collaboration with soul singer Leroy Bell. And, I got the opportunity to talk to a guitar player before the shit hit the fan in my life and in the world. Well, obviously the shit has been hitting in the fan. The shit has been hitting the fan in the world for a while. But you know what I'm saying. So I took it and I talked to him. And it's, it's me talking to G.E. Smith about guitars and stuff. Maybe that'll be nice for you. I don't know. Maybe you want a break. I've been ranting and raving about encroaching fascism in this country for, since 2016? I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't think these protests are going to stop, and I'm not sure they should. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of injustice. And I've just got to protect my mind from hopelessness. You know what I'm saying? And now I've become very focused on my cat, Monkey, who is ill, old. Some days are better than others. But in this void, in this absence of Lynn here, I wake up at 4 in the morning and I go through the memories. Most of them good. It's hard. It hurts. I'm not obsessing about bad things. But then I realize I got a sick old cat downstairs. So I've gotten into the habit where I'll go downstairs and lay on the couch and see if Monkey wants to get on my chest and lay there. My old sick cat. And, just love the cat. it's weird, you know? It's weird to be a guy who's 56 years old and is just sort of getting the hang of what love feels like, to give it and get it, you know, receive it and let it out. And I just started realizing, like, well, I don't know how much time I got with this cat. So I go down there at like 4 a.m. with a blanket, and I lay on the couch and hang out with Monkey for a couple hours, in and out of sleep, thinking about life, thinking about Lynn, thinking about the end of the world, listening to my cat purr, and then that kind of levels it off. The purr of an old cat is kind of like some sort of universal frequency of calm. I don't even know how he does it. I can't do it. A purr's got, like, there's several different layers of sound going on. Sounds like 2 or 3 different layers of sound for a good, wheezy old cat. So I've been doing that, just talking to cats, just yelling at Monkey, like, what's going on? Are you dying? Is today the day? Are we dying today? Do we have to go to the vet and die today, Monkey? So G.E. Smith has this new album coming out. It's a collaboration with soul singer Leroy Bell. You guys know him. You might have been annoyed by him on Saturday Night Live. He brought that up. Some people were very annoyed by him. But this is me and G.E. Smith coming right up. What's up, G.E.? How you feeling?
Everything's good, Mark.
Looks like a comfortable situation up there. Where are you?
Amagansett, out on Long Island.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
But you don't come from there. You just, that's where you settled, huh?
Yes. I've been here for a long time, 40 years.
Is that by the water?
It's not far from the water. You don't really want to live right on the water unless it's just a summer house.
Uh-huh.
Because the wind off the ocean just tears the house apart, you know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really rough. You know, the people that live right by the water, they're just spending money all the time.
Fixing the house?
Yeah.
So where'd you grow up?
In Pennsylvania.
Like rural?
Stroudsburg.
Where is it in relation to a city?
It's in the Northeast. If you're coming across Route 80 from anywhere in the West, when you get right to the New Jersey border, it's called Delaware Water Gap.
Oh, okay.
And it's the next town west of that.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, it was just a tiny little town.
Yeah. You know?
But now, like every place else, it's all grown up and there's lots of people there. And there's about 1,000 people that, when they were working, commuted every day to the city.
Oh, it's one of those commuter towns.
Yeah.
Did your dad work in the city?
No. My dad worked right there.
Yeah.
He worked right there. He was an engineer, structural and chemical engineer, and he worked, you know, for a big company there. And
oh, really? Not for the city, just for a big corporation? Big,
yep.
So, and your mom, did she work too?
Yep. My grandmother, who I grew up with, had a gift shop in town, Holiday Gift Center, and my mom always worked there with her.
Oh, that's nice. Like cards and stuff?
All that kind of stuff, you know, little glass
things,
you know, all kinds of stuff, jewelry, you know.
Yeah, you don't see many of those general gift shops anymore. There was always one of those where it was just like a little bit of everything, little tchotchkes that, you know, people could walk through and go like, oh, that would be nice.
Right?
Easy.
Yeah. And when I was a kid, at least, it was a big summer area. A lot of people from the city had second homes there.
Yeah.
And so in the summer, it'd be crowded, and there was a lot of people around, a lot of jazz musicians from the city.
From Philadelphia or from New York?
From New York City.
Uh-huh.
Would come there in the summertime. So when I was a kid, you know, when I was like 12, 13, 14, I got to hear a lot of great music.
Really? Where'd they play? Out in the, they have an outdoor thing?
Nope, there's a bar, a place called the Deer Head Inn.
Uh-huh.
That was a jazz spot.
And they let you in?
No, but I could sit on the porch. And like sometimes I'd go over there in the afternoon and sit out on the porch, and these guys would be in there rehearsing. And I heard a lot of great jazz players. John Coates, this piano player. Pharoah Saunders, the sax player.
Yeah.
Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, you know, a lot of those guys from the 50s, 60s jazz scene were there in the summertime.
Wow. And you just like took it in. Were you playing guitar yet? When did you start that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I started playing. I got a guitar when I was four.
Four?
And by, yep. There were, I went down in the basement with my mother to do, she was going to do the laundry.
Yeah.
And there was a old guitar hanging on the wall. I said, "What's that?" She said, "That's called a guitar that used to belong to your Uncle George." And I said, "Can I have it?" She said, "Sure. It's been hanging up there for a long time." So she gave it to me and I just got obsessed with it.
What was that guitar?
It was just a cheap acoustic guitar.
Like a Harmony or a K or something?
Collegiate brand.
Uh-huh.
It was like a Harmony.
Yeah.
You know, probably made in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Like a lot of that stuff was back then. And
And that started it.
I still have that guitar, but it's long gone.
Oh yeah. I have an old K from the 50s, and a K acoustic that, you know,
they make great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds okay. You know, it's got a spray paint. It's like the pick guard is painted on. It's like not even
right.
Yeah. I got that. A lot
of the great blues records were made on those kind of guitars. You know,
I know they. You can feel that. You hear the sound. I once interviewed Taj Mahal in here.
Yeah.
And he picked the thing up. He didn't want to play, but he picked that thing up for 2 seconds and played like a Skip James riff and moved it and kind of tracked it into the African groove in like 3 seconds. You know, he just brought the thing to life. Like it was almost like a time machine. It was fucking unbelievable.
No, Taj is great. And he's a real musicologist.
You know,
he really knows. He's a very, very smart guy and knows his stuff. There's a bar here in Amagansett in this town where I live called the Stephen Talk House.
Yeah.
And they get, especially during the summer when all the people from the city are out here, they get big acts, you know, national acts. And I went there one time to see Taj. This is probably like in the 80s. And he had a band and they were great and they were playing. And at some point he got up from where he was in front of the band and he picked up an acoustic guitar, an old National, you know, metal body National.
Yeah.
And he kind of went up in the back of the stage and leaned against the wall and he played this old blues song. I think it's a Charlie Patton song. It's called Peavine Blues.
Yeah.
And he just played it all alone. No microphones.
Yeah.
It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
That's wild, man. I when people can channel that stuff. I had a similar experience in Tucson, Arizona, at the Tucson, Arizona Blues Society. I was visiting my brother, and they had paid John Hammond Jr. to come out. So it was just like 40 people in there. And he did the same thing with Hellhounds on My Trail. Him.
He does the Robert Johnson stuff.
Man, and like to hear that stuff played properly is fucking crazy, man.
It really is.
Yeah,
it really is.
He's really an interesting player too. But so is Smith the family name?
Yeah, Smith. My family's Lebanese. My father was Lebanese.
Yeah,
and I grew up very much in that, like the food, you know, because I said my grandmother was there, you know, my dad's mom, so she was 100% Lebanese. My father's 100% Lebanese. So I grew up with that food and that kind of atmosphere, you know. And the family name had been Haddad.
Uh-huh.
And Haddad in Arabic means blacksmith.
Yeah.
And the legend was that when my great-grandfather, whose name was Boutros Haddad, when he came over, he didn't speak English, but they had written on a piece of paper in Arabic and then in English, Haddad, and then they'd written blacksmith underneath it.
Right.
And the legend is he gets to Ellis Island and the guy, the immigration guy, looks at it and he says, "Well, what do you want to be, black or Smith?" And he didn't even know what the guy was saying and he just pointed at Smith, and that's how we wound up being Smith.
That's a good story.
Yeah, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's a good story.
So when you start playing, when do you get the first guitar that you make a choice to get?
So when I was seven, by then I had figured out some chords and it was the folk music thing was happening, you know, what they call the folk scare.
Yeah. No, folks scare.
Yeah.
And who calls it that?
Oh, a lot of guys in the business call it that. You know. I was learning that kind of stuff. And a woman was at our came over to our house, and she saw me playing that collegiate, you know, instrument. And she said, "Oh, you can play, you know." She said, "Do you want a real guitar? I'm 7. What am I going to say? Yeah,
yeah,
you know." So then a couple of days later, she shows up with a little Martin, you know, a good acoustic guitar.
Wow!
And not only that, she brought along the girl that was working for her as a nanny, who was like maybe a 14, 15 year old Irish girl.
Uh huh.
And that she showed me some stuff. This Irish girl.
Uh huh.
She showed me how to finger pick.
Really?
Know, which was so great because
I want to do that better.
Oh man, before that I was playing with a pick.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was doing, you know, but she showed me that what they call Travis picking, you know, it's like the alternating bass with the thumb.
Yeah.
And then you pick out the melody with your fingers.
All three fingers?
That was great. I was really lucky that I got that when I was that young.
I talked to guys that do the blues two-finger picking thing.
A lot of guys, the real guys, would do just one finger.
Yeah.
Thumb and one finger. But I use all five. See, I got this big, long fingernail.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do these rakes with that, you know. Hrang, you
oh,
know?
That's not for coke?
No.
That was that used to be the thing that they did in the
80s. Yeah, no, I know it was. Yeah, people would always say that to me. But no, yeah. I always just let my fingernails grow long to play, you know.
Yeah, do the picking. So the Irish girl showed you how to finger pick, and then you locked into that. That's a good thing to knock out when you're young, huh?
I was lucky.
Yeah. And then what, how does the style evolve?
In January of 1963, it was my 11th birthday.
Yeah.
And I wanted an electric guitar.
Right.
So my mother took me around. There was a couple of little music stores out in the country or, you know, and we looked at some electric guitars and we found a used Fender Telecaster.
Yeah.
And we got it. It was $100. I was born in January 1952. And some years later, when I found out you could take the neck off the guitar and see the date, the guitar is January of 1952.
No shit.
Yeah.
You're both born in the same 11.
And I was then starting to play in bands.
That's got to be one of the first ones, right?
Yeah, pretty early. 1950 was the first ones.
A first Telecaster or first Broadcaster?
Broadcaster was 1950. Broadcaster and Esquire.
Right.
1950. Then by 51, they're making no more Broadcasters. They're making Esquires and Telecasters.
And the difference was with the Telecasters, they added that pickup?
Telecaster had the neck pickup on it, too.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Funny, my guitar says Esquire, but it's got the two pickups.
Huh.
But they did make, you know, Fender always just made whatever they needed to make that day, you know, use all the parts that they had and ship them out. So I figure it must have been one of those or I don't know.
But, so that was the guitar. And then you're 11 and you got a Telecaster and you're playing in bands already?
Yes, there was some older folks, probably like in their 30s, you know, and they had a band. And dude, there were so few musicians there that
where you lived,
it was such a small town. And my parents knew everybody. So my dad knew these people and I got into this little band and it was like, you know, kind of lounge music, you know, standards,
sure,
old time stuff and some polka music. Cause it's Pennsylvania, you know,
right.
It was an accordion in the band, the guy with an acoustic guitar. It was hysterical.
But you learned those chords? You learned that groove? I learned.
Yeah. See, that was great. I got right away. I started learning songs
and the polka, you know, groove. Like, check
not just blues based songs at all. But, you know, like standards.
We
changed Nat King Cole songs. And
right.
Stuff. Louis Armstrong. My grandmother listened to Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Duke Ellington, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so I had heard that stuff since I was a baby on her floor.
Yeah.
So I had that in my head. I had those, that sound in my ear.
Yeah.
And that was very fortunate, you know, to be able to start out with that good music.
But yeah, but you're like, but it seems to me that the core of who you are as a guitar player is a blues trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, that's the music that I really loved. And then, like, you know, when the Beatles came out, about a year after I got that Telecaster, the Beatles came out and I liked the Beatles and I thought they were really cool, but I didn't want to play that.
Yeah.
You know, that, but then when the Rolling Stones came out and the Kinks,
right.
When I first heard You Really Got Me, that boom, wah, 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 wah.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Oh yes. I get it now. Electric guitar. That's what it does.
So that's the rock element. Where do you get your first dose of real guitar blues?
When the Stones came out,
yeah,
the Yardbirds and those bands,
oh yeah,
I would, you know, obsessively read the album covers,
right?
And they, you know, the old, you know, sure. LP,
yeah,
you know, and that had who wrote the songs,
right?
And I'm seeing these names, you know, and I'm reading interviews with the Stones and the Yardbirds and the Who and those bands. And they're talking about Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James.
Right.
So then I went and got those records.
Yeah. That's weird.
I ordered those records from the little music store in town, you know.
You got them to, oh, they ordered them for you?
Yeah. I had to order. They didn't have those in stock, you know.
They were hard to find, you know, even when I was a kid. I mean, there were collections and stuff, but, you know, the real stuff is, So it was Muddy and Howlin' Wolf, the regular guys, Elmore James.
I loved Elmore James.
Yeah, it's great. So you're fucking around with that slide?
Yeah, slide, which of course I didn't know that it was slide. I didn't know what that was when I first heard it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
In the middle 64, 65, I heard that. I didn't know what it was. But then I saw Brian Jones play with the Stones. I saw him play slide and I went, oh, he's got this thing on his finger. Makes that sound.
Where'd you see the Stones?
I saw them in 1965 in Atlantic City at the Steel Pier, and the McCoys opened. Hang on, Sloopy.
Sure,
you know, Rick Derringer.
Rick Derringer, yeah.
Yeah.
So what was that? Do you remember that being in terms of in looking back? I mean, you've played with everybody and you've seen everybody, but at that age, at that time, those guys, was it a great fucking show?
It was. To me, it was like the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I love the Stones. I also that year saw The Who.
Ah.
And
65?
65, yeah.
Oh,
and that
wow.
was, that changed my life, you know. Years later, when I got to work with all these people, you know, I would always ask, especially the English guys.
Yeah.
When you were coming up, I asked Jagger, I asked David Bowie. A bunch of different guys. I said, when you were first coming up, now let's leave your band out of it, but who was the best live band? Every single one of them said The Who.
Really?
Yeah. Nobody ever said anything else. The Who.
That's wild. Of course.
When I asked Jagger that, I didn't even finish the question. He just went, The Who.
So they all like to watch. They all went to watch The Who.
Yeah. The Who live because great songs. They could all really play and they could sing. They could really sing just like the record because Townsend and Entwistle would sing the background vocals and Daughtry singing the lead. They had the harmonies. They were doing it, you know?
And they could
really play that stuff live.
And oddly, you know, the sound, I mean, no one plays guitar like that guy.
Nope.
Right? It's some sort of like power, rhythm, lead, hybrid.
It's rhythm, lead. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was really unique, and he always said, Townsend always said, you know, that he was a banjo player first, but not like country finger picking banjo.
Skiffle.
Plectrum banjo, you know, with a pick.
Yeah.
So he learned all those rang, rang, rang things from playing banjo and then translated it onto the guitar. And, you know, obviously a great songwriter and a very angry guy, you know, so that anger came out in the music and they were just great. You know, their song, I Can't Explain.
Yep.
The Who record. You listen to that. I mean, I bought that 45 when it came out in 65.
Yeah.
You listen to that record. That's live in the studio. There's no overdubs on that record. When Townsend and Entwistle come in with the background vocal, I can't explain.
Yeah.
You hear the compression, you hear the cymbals go away because they went up to their microphones and the drums weren't bleeding anymore. You know, you hear it on the record. When the guitar solo comes on, the rhythm guitar stops because he's playing the solo now. He can't play rhythm guitar. That's an amazing record, but that really shows, you know, how good they were live.
Yeah, I you know, I came to The Who late. I liked some of the, I always liked The Who, but I was like not a fanatic, you know, when I was a kid. But now, you know, that live at Leeds and all of it is pretty amazing. Yeah, his anger is great. You work with Roger Waters for a while. That guy's angry too. I talked to him too. He's angry. He's an angry dude.
He's another guy, real smart guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, real poet, real political activist, got a real chip on his shoulder for fairly righteous reasons.
Yep.
It was funny because I talked to him, you know, he's one of these guys, a lot of times you talk to these dudes, you know, who are known for one thing, a singular thing, and they always think they're doing their best work now, you know, of course. So, So he tells me, he's like, I don't want to talk about Pink Floyd. And I'm like, what are we going to fucking do then, right? So, but like within 5 minutes, he was talking about Pink Floyd. It doesn't matter.
I worked with Roger for 6 years.
6 years.
Yeah, we went all over the world, you know, doing the Wall.
Yeah, that must have been. Now, how, you know, in doing something like that, so you're playing the Gilmore parts, basically?
No. I played a lot of bass in the show.
Oh, wow.
Because Roger was acting.
Interesting.
I did play some guitar.
Yeah.
But there's a guy named Dave Kilminster. Uh-huh. That plays with Roger, who does the Gilmore thing.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Okay. So you're playing.
He's got it. Great, great musician. And Snowy White was also in the band. So there were three guitar players.
Uh-huh.
But I played bass on probably about 80% of the show because Roger was acting. You know, The Wall was very much a theatrical performance. You know?
People love that thing, man.
I've never seen fanatical fans. Like those Pink Floyd, Roger Waters fans.
No kidding.
They are fanatical.
Yeah, it runs deep with them. They, you know,
even when I worked with Bob Dylan, who obviously has very fanatical fans.
Yeah.
You know, in a kind of a different way.
Yeah, they're all like 70 now.
A lot of them are 70, but there's younger ones too, you know. But what always really got me was like with Bob and with Roger. There's people that really think that song was written for them specifically.
Sure.
Right. Even though they knew that Bob didn't know them or anything, Bob wrote that for me.
It speaks to him.
It beyond speaking to him. It's a weird kind of obsession.
No kidding. Know? Well, the thing about The Wall, you know, and that album in particular, it's sort of a kind of timeless encapsulation of an adolescent anger that goes all through your life. And I think that, you know, the possibility of that continuing to attract generations of younger people forever is probably pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah. When we would play, you know, I mean, obviously with Roger, we played the big places, you know, we'd have minimum 25, 30,000 people at any show, up to 90,000, 100,000, you know, depending on where it was outdoors. And the audience range would be from in their 70s to young teenagers.
Right.
And they all knew the words. Yeah. And everybody sang the songs. And
yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's powerful. So what's this dynamic with, like, you know, in terms of you got Muddy, you got Elmore, and you got, you know, Howlin' and Wolf.
Yep.
But like I've seen you speak about this this Bloomfield obsession.
Yes.
Now, like, you know, he's a guy like kind of fascinates me. So do you think that first Paul Butterfield album, that's the one that kind of blew your mind out in terms of how you approach guitar?
Definitely. That record, which from everything I've ever been able to find out, they started recording right at the end. It's 1964.
Yeah.
And nobody can imagine now how that's unimaginable that a bunch of, you know, these young white guys from Chicago were so into that music. They had been hanging out in the clubs. They knew Muddy. They knew Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
They had gotten up on stage and sat in with them. You know?
Little Walter.
And they were smart enough. Butterfield did this. You know, when he put that band together, he hired Sam Lay and Jerome Arnold, the drummer and the bass player from Howlin' Wolf's band.
Right.
And I just saw the other night in a little interview with Sam Lay. And he said, well, yeah, the reason I went with Butterfield is because he offered me $20 a show. And with Wolf, I got $7 a show. So it was just like a financial thing for him, you know, gig. But yeah, that record is to me really groundbreaking. Like in my mind, in my world, that's right up there with like the Beatles or something, you know.
Right.
That's a life-changing record for me.
So you're saying that this was the first example of a bunch of white kids who weren't just covering the songs, they were living the life and directly, you know, in mentorship with the original guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And Bloomfield's playing on that record, it's very stylistically correct. He's playing the blues.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But he's playing it so technically advanced.
Right.
From almost anything that had been played before. Almost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were people. Hubert Sumlin was Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah.
Played some stuff. There's a Howlin' Wolf song called Louise.
Yeah.
That was recorded in, I think, 61 or something, where Wolf, it's a great song. Wolf's singing great. But Hubert plays a solo in that song that says everything anybody's going to say for the next 10 years.
About
Bloomfield, Clapton,
yeah,
Jimmy Page, whoever you want to talk about.
Yeah.
Hubert's solo on Louise says it all.
That's the template? That's
yep. To that, me.
Yeah. I got to check that out because I've listened to a lot of stuff, but I can't identify that in my head. And
yeah, like, people don't know that song, but listen to that and listen to Hubert solo, the way he comes in and the notes he chooses, and it's just brilliant.
Yeah. Are you friends with Vivino?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I know Jimmy, like, because I used to do, you know, I'm a comic. I do Conan a lot, and Jimmy would always, you know, let me play one of his guitars and show me licks and stuff.
He's got a lot of great guitars.
Yeah, and he's also, you know, he's also one of those guys, not unlike you. You know, he studied the guys, right?
Oh yeah.
So you know, if you've got a question, he can resolve it for you. But he produced that. I think he produced a record for Hubert later on.
Yeah, he did a bunch of stuff with Hubert. I got to be good friends with Hubert.
And, yeah,
that was a real honor. You know.
Yeah, he's an interesting guitar player.
He was interesting and real wonderful guy.
What about Bloomfield?
No, I never met Bloomfield.
Yeah, but Hubert, you got to know him, huh? He lived a long time.
Yeah, Hubert I got to know. And we would do gigs, and a couple times I picked him up, and we would have like maybe drive from New York down to Washington, D.C. or something.
Oh, yeah.
Me and him in the car. So we really got to talk.
Oh, that's beautiful, man.
Yeah, it was great.
So you heard some of the good stories, huh?
Heard some good stories. He had like a kind of stock repertoire
of
stories.
Yeah, they do.
But we had spent enough time together that he got away from those. And we really had some good talks. He was a very expressive guy. And he told me some great stuff.
That's great. Yeah,
he taught me a great chicken recipe. He taught me a great thing, how to cook. Because he was a good cook.
Oh, yeah? Is it simple?
Yeah, it's simple. Yeah, simple thing. You get one of those rotisserie chickens
from
the market. It's already cooked. And you bring it home and you cut it up and you got to carefully take the skin off.
Yeah.
You know, and then you put you melt some butter in a big iron skillet.
Yeah.
And you fry that skin and you fry up some of the chicken meat.
Yeah.
And you take the wings and you fry the wings in that butter, you know, so they get really crispy and good. Man, it's good. I just had that last night. Hubert Sumlin chicken.
Oh yeah, I talked to Buddy Guy, and he's got he's got one of those repertoire, the blues man repertoire.
Oh yeah, he's amazing.
He is amazing. Both him and Hubert really kind of like they go out there, man. There's nothing, you know, kind of average. And it's not a matter of average, but they take real risks. I mean, they do some weird shit on their guitars.
Oh yeah, Buddy. I made a record with Buddy with the Saturday Night Live band. Yeah, when I was doing the TV show, after I was on, I started in 1985.
Right.
After I was on a couple of years, the show had gotten pretty successful.
Yeah, I remember seeing you. You were like the first thing everyone saw, almost.
Yeah. You know, that was nice. You know, Lorne gave me that spot there. Lorne Michaels, the producer.
Yeah.
He gave me those little spots, and I really owe a great debt to him.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's nothing as powerful as TV in the United States.
Yeah.
And that really got people to know me and what I was playing and stuff. But anyway, after we'd been on like 2 years, maybe 3 years, by about 88, I could get a guitar player who was in town, anybody that was passing through town, and they would sit in with the band. And this wouldn't be announced or anything.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
The camera would come up, and there would be Hubert Sumlin, or David Gilmour, or Johnny Winter, or Eddie Van Halen, you know, all different kind of, but just great guitar players.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful to get to do that and play with all those different guys and get to hang out with them and stuff. That was, because I'm a fan, you know.
Yeah, of course. So, I'm got to actually do a record with Buddy, huh?
Got to do so we had Buddy Guy on. He was in town playing, and he liked the band, the musicians in the Saturday Night Live band. Only a corporation like NBC could afford to hire that band,
right?
Because they're like the best. They're all great jazz guys.
Yeah.
You know, I'm this bar band guitar player,
and
I get to be in that band with these incredible musicians. Yeah. I learned so much there.
Yeah, it must be nice to have that behind you. I mean, to have a band backing you. They're never going to let you fall down, right?
Nope. I had to work to keep up with them. Believe me.
I believe you.
You know, to try to like play up to their standards.
Which record did you do with Buddy?
It's called I think it's called The Real Deal.
Oh, okay.
The live record. We did two nights in New York City and two nights in Chicago at Buddy's Club. We did some great stuff. I got him to do an Elmore James song.
Oh, great. Yeah.
You know, things like that, like not from maybe his normal repertoire. And one night we were playing and Buddy was just on.
Yeah.
And he was just the sound he was getting, you know, the electric, it just filled the air.
Yeah.
You know, it was just incredible. And he hits a note and he holds his guitar up in the air and he looks at me and he goes, "Man, I got some extortion on my amp tonight." I said, "Extortion on my amp." And I used to think when those guys would say those kind of things, because Hubert would say stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
They knew exactly what they were saying. It's poetry.
Right.
It's poetry. These guys are geniuses, you know?
Listen
to Sonny Boy Williamson's records. He is a poet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic lyrical content.
He was funny,
too.
And
they talk like that.
Yeah.
The guys, the real blues guys.
Yeah. So the Telecaster thing and the Bloomfield thing, I mean, I saw you talk about your, the G.E. Smith signature Tele.
Right.
Which I'd never seen it before. And now I feel like I need to find one. But that commitment to the Telecaster is sort of interesting. So, because Bloomfield eventually went to a 59 Les Paul, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm a big Peter Green guy. Peter Green, what do you think about him?
Fabulous. Are you kidding? The Supernatural? You know that song?
Yeah.
Supernatural? What is that? Nobody else ever did anything like that. That is impossible to play.
Yeah, he was out there, dude. He was so good.
He was so good. The great blues phrasing.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
He was very, obviously, very influential
amongst
guitar players. You know, Kirk Hammett has his guitar.
I know, Greeny. He's got it. And my buddy knows him. And he said I could come play it one day, which is just crazy.
Wow.
I wouldn't mind doing that. I mean, do you feel...
just to touch it.
Yeah.
Just to touch your hands to it.
So you kind of feel that, right? You know, you know that these old guitars and these guitars that were used by certain people, they've got a magic to them, right?
Well, I think that there's a psychological factor when you pick up a guitar like that.
Yeah.
And you know the music that was played on it.
Yeah.
It's inspirational.
Yeah. That's right.
You know the funny thing though that I found? I got to play a lot of the the famous guitars that people have. Like I got to play, you know, Clapton's Blackie, Stratocaster.
Yeah.
You know, I got to play Neil Young's Black Les Paul.
What, that old Neil weird P90 thing with the tremolo on it?
Yeah, with the P90 and the Firebird pickup. And yeah. And both of those guitars, if they didn't belong to Neil and Eric.
Yeah.
And just it belonged to just some guy, and he walked into a vintage guitar store and tried to sell it. You wouldn't be able to sell it. You know, it's not like this. You know, in the vintage guitar world, there's this like it's got to be all original, and it's got to
right.
Guitars were pieced together. You know, put together things.
Right, they're ruined. They're ruined in the eyes
they're
of a
ruined vintage. In a way. Yeah, but. Look what they did in the hands of these guys that had them.
Yeah, wild.
You know, so it's the person. It's not the guitar.
I think that's true. I just bought a 60 Les Paul Jr.
Oh, man, great guitar.
Double cutaway. It's fucking great. Yeah. So
you have the real thin neck. A lot of 60s have that really skinny neck.
Yeah, it's really thin.
They have a sound.
They do, man.
Spanky, they call it. They got a spanking sound.
Yeah, right? I plug it into that 53, and it's like, it's magic.
Magic.
Yeah. So you were at SNL, but you played. Now tell me about this band, and we'll get to the new record. But you know, I don't want to keep you too long. But I can't imagine we got too much to do. But what is this Roger C. Real and the Morgue?
Rue Morgue.
Rue Morgue.
Like you know the French word for street.
Yeah, Roger C. Real and the Rue Morgue.
Right. So in 1971, when I was 19. I was still in my hometown of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
I would always play, you know, I've been playing by now I'm playing 7 nights a week.
Yeah.
You know, I would play any gig, whatever kind of music, any place, whatever. I didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, as long as I was playing, I'm still that way. And, but in 71, a buddy of mine had been to Vietnam. He's a Hammond organ player, guy from my hometown.
Yeah.
And I'd been in bands with him, and he had been to Vietnam and then come home and went to the New Haven University, like GI Bill thing, right? So he's up there in the New Haven area. And he calls me up like in the late spring, around this time of year, and he says, hey, our guitar player and his band up there, our guitar player has to go in the hospital and get an operation or something. He said, he's going to be out for 2 weeks. Can you come up and fill in for him? I said, sure. So I went up to Connecticut. I never went, never looked back.
That was it.
Yeah, I just got up there and got in this band, and I stole the guy's spot, you know, in the band. But so I get in this band after about a year or two called the Scratch Band.
Scratch Band.
And the Scratch Band was a Connecticut band. I have my old calendars from like 75, 76 and stuff.
Yeah.
We would play 250 gigs a year and never leave Connecticut.
Really?
Yeah. And you know how big Connecticut is, right?
I know. Yeah, man.
There used to be a lot of places to play live music. So I was in that band, and that band worked out of a recording studio in a town called Wallingford, Connecticut, which is just north of New Haven.
Yeah.
And Roger Real was around there at that studio.
Got it.
And in 1977, you know, by now, we're listening to a lot of reggae. It was a big Jamaican community in Hartford, Connecticut. And me and Bob Orsi, one of the other guys in the Scratch Band, would go up to Hartford to the Beltone record shop and get all these incredible records just in from Jamaica. You know, we're listening to that stuff. And then the punk stuff is starting to come out of England.
Yeah.
You know, the early punk stuff. And Roger Real's really into that. And I'm listening to that stuff too. So he says, I want to make a record. You know, would you play on it? Because he knows that I know that style of playing.
Right.
And so we made this record. And I thought it was a really good record at the time, but this tiny little studio had no means of getting it out there
right.
where people hear it or anything.
Yeah.
You know? So it kind of just, there it was. And it was something cool I had done. It's one of my favorite records that I've ever recorded on. But, and then recently in the last couple of years, it resurfaced somehow, and some people put some money into it and remastered it, and they've put it out, and it's making a little noise, you know, so.
Yeah, I listened to it. It's great.
There's some good stuff on that record.
Yeah, and you sound great. And is that still that 53 Tele?
That actually on that record, it's a 55 Tele, because by then I was buying old guitars, you know, and had a lot of stuff. I still have the 52 Tele that my mom got me. I've had that my whole life and played that with everybody. I took it on the road with Bob Dylan, you know, for 4 years and played all over the world.
Your first Tele with Bob Dylan for 4 years?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When you toured, what album was that through?
Well, I don't know what album. I played with him live shows from 88. And then the last thing I did was in 1992 when they did that big Bob Dylan 30th anniversary concert at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
Bob hired me to be like the musical director for that. And
your relationship with him was good?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, how big of an operation was it when you were playing with him? Who was in the band?
Well, he had in the previous couple years before 88, when I started with him, he had done a tour with the Grateful Dead backing him up.
No, I remember that. Yeah.
Then he did a tour with Tom Petty and the
Heartbreakers. Yeah, yeah.
Right. A great band, man. Great band.
Yeah, great band. Yeah.
Tom and the Heartbreakers always delivered. I saw them a lot. But he had done those tours with those very established bands.
Yeah.
Right? So now I think he wanted to get a small band of just some guys that weren't necessarily, you know, an established unit
right.
that he would have to kind of fit into.
Right.
He wanted somebody that was going to fit into him.
Right.
So he hired me and a couple buddies of mine and you know, we went out and played. It was just a trio, you know, guitar, bass and drums and Bob.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Did you do a record with him?
I never recorded with him other than live stuff,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
No, I never did any studio work with him.
And when you work with him, because he's a guy that approaches his own music so differently, you know, over and over again.
Right.
What was it about the way you guys worked together, what he expected of you, or how did it evolve? How'd you guys do the songs differently? And what's his genius in approaching his own music?
I think that what he liked about me and that band was that he likes to change. He doesn't like to play the song the same way.
Right.
All the time. You know, a lot of people I've worked with, it's the same every time, you know, they get a show together.
And, yeah.
And that's kind of the way it is. And the song goes like this and that's it. Bob liked to change stuff up and we were able to follow him. You know, I was able to, cause I always love doing that. My favorite thing is to play with a good singer.
Yeah.
Songwriter person
right.
and just follow them. Just watch their hands. A lot of times with Bob, he would just start some song that we had never heard in front of 15,000 people, you know, and we'd just play it. I would just follow along with him and we'd play it.
It's like playing with Chuck Berry.
In a way.
I mean, there's that story about Chuck Berry when, who was it? Was Bruce Springsteen. He'd always hire the local guys to back him. And I don't think it was Bruce. Bruce goes, you know, what are we playing? And Chuck goes, Chuck Berry songs.
Chuck Berry songs. Yeah, exactly.
So what was your big break with the, you know, playing these with, what got you in with these guys? I mean, how did you start in the legit music business?
Yeah, the legit music. I'm still not in the legit music business. I'm playing in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Right. And at some point, a guy named Dan Hartman, who had been in the Edgar Winter group, he wrote Free Ride.
Oh, yeah.
Come on and take a free ride.
Yeah.
He was the bass player in that group. But he wrote great songs, Dan. And Dan had made a record and wanted to go out and tour behind his record. And he had seen me play with the Scratch Band.
Right.
And so he had a home, a studio in Westport, Connecticut. Dan passed away some years ago. But another great guy, and happened to be from Pennsylvania. So I've played with a lot of Pennsylvania. I played with Daryl Hall and John Oates, you know, Pennsylvania guys. Then I just started meeting people and getting these different gigs, you know. And I was at a party one time in New York City, and David Bowie was at the party. And David had a woman named Coco that worked with him for many, many years.
Yeah.
And Coco came over to me at this party and she said, I'd like you, you know, David wants to meet you. So I go over and say hello to David. I'm thrilled, you know, I can't believe it. And then a little later, she comes back over and she says, David's doing a video tomorrow. Do you want to be in it?
Yeah.
And I said, well, yeah, of course. And she said, great. And she tells me where it is and what time, you know, 2 o'clock. And I said, should I bring my guitar? And she goes, you're a guitar player? And I said, yeah. She goes, wait a minute. And she goes over, and then she comes back, bring your guitar. You can play the part of the guitar player in the video.
Yeah.
And then I wound up doing a very limited amount of live playing with David, but I did get to play with him a little bit. So, you know, you'd just be somewhere and you'd meet somebody. And then.
But did you you recorded with Hall & Oates though, right?
Yeah, yeah, a lot. Yeah. A lot. I was with them from 79 or 78. Maybe to 85.
And that's when you got the SNL gig.
And then I had been around SNL in the late 70s, in the first 5 years.
Oh, because you were involved with Gilda, right? Didn't you marry Gilda?
And Gilda were married, yeah. She did a one-woman show on Broadway.
Yeah.
In the summer of 78, and I was in the house band there. That's how we met.
No kidding.
Yeah.
She was kind of amazing, right?
He was the greatest, man. Nice, nice person.
Yeah, so funny, so talented. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Hall & Oates, they were like hit machines, man. I mean,
they were huge. When I joined them, they were kind of in a slump. They had like the Sarah Smile Rich Girl.
Yeah,
mid-70s, 75, 74, 75.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got real big. But then some stuff that they did didn't hit as hard. And when they hired me, at first, I was getting $200 a week, $100 to play guitar, and $100 to drive one of the station wagons.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we were playing bars.
No kidding. That way, yeah, they went down that hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Holy shit.
You know, the business is very, the music business is very unforgiving, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, but I mean,
you're
it seems.
On the top or you're not.
Wow.
But then pretty quick, within about a year, we were recording and they started having some hits, and then Private Eyes was the first one that was a number one, and then they just got huge. Wow. You know, Man Eater,
yeah,
and You Make My Dreams Come True, so many songs.
Wow. You know, but in between Sarah Smile and Man Eater, they were playing dives.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that must have been a fucking lesson.
Yeah, but for me, you know, it was the same kind of places I'd always been playing when I first started.
Yeah.
So it was no different. But then when it took off, then all of a sudden now we're playing, you know, the big arenas in towns, and we're traveling, and they got gigantically huge in Japan. We would go to Japan for weeks.
Wow.
And base out of Tokyo and fly out to Osaka and Fukuoka and Nagoya and Hokkaido and all those places.
That must have been exciting.
It was amazing. It was wonderful. And that was my first taste of like the big time, you know.
Yeah,
playing
yeah.
with them. So it was really exciting. And you know, we were young, and a band like that, a pop band like that attracts, you know, a lot of beautiful girls.
That's for
sure.
Know, yeah, yeah. That. Seemed like yeah. it. Yeah, yeah. So that's fun.
It was.
What about like when you recorded with Jagger? Yeah, did you feel that there was tension in the band, in the Stones?
I didn't know anything about the Stones because I, at that point, I only knew Mick.
Yeah.
Later, I got to, you know, meet Keith. And
but I mean, you love the Stones.
Bill Wyman and stuff. Yeah.
You love the Stones. You know, Jagger was doing a solo record. How'd he pick you to do it?
I mean, we were around. Mick was living in Manhattan, and I was living in Manhattan, and we were around.
Okay. You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I had met him.
Yeah.
And, I was doing Saturday Night Live, so
yeah.
he had seen me.
Okay,
and he would come to the show and stuff. I remember sitting with him watching Stevie Ray Vaughan play.
Oh wow, really?
Yeah, you know, and talking about Stevie and how he played and stuff.
Wow.
But
what'd you think of that? You know, Stevie was something, huh?
Oh, it's great. Stevie to me is the ultimate, and I mean this as a compliment. I mean this not in any derogatory way.
Yeah.
He's the ultimate bar band guitar player.
Right.
The ultimate. He could cover somebody else's song, cover a Jimi Hendrix song.
Yeah.
Do it pretty much almost as good, you know, as Jimmy did it.
Yeah.
Which is really going somewhere.
Yeah.
Nobody else could do that.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so Stevie was fabulous and really based in the blues, knew what he was doing, could really play, and a sweet guy.
Yeah, it's so sad. Like, yeah, it's so sad, man, the way he went down because he and he was clean and just like, what a fucking horrible accident.
At that place, Alpine Valley, I had just played there two nights before with Dylan.
Wow.
That same gig. And then 2 days later, Stevie plays and that thing happened. And I remember being at soundcheck and we heard the news.
Mm.
And we were just devastated.
Oh, gosh, just terrible, terrible. His brother's a good player too.
Jimmy's great and a great guy.
Great guy.
An amazing guy.
Yeah.
He was in the Fabulous Thunderbirds.
Yeah, I love him. Love the
and
Fabulous
in the 70s, Thunderbirds. Like mid-70s when I was still in the scratch band living in Connecticut, we would go and see the Thunderbirds.
Great.
And man, they were great.
I loved it. Yeah, I love seeing them. I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They came and did this old biker bar, the Golden Inn, in between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And I was in high school, and I was like, got to see these fuckers.
Yep. So, now, you grew up out there? You grew up in Albuquerque?
I did, cool. Yeah.
I like Albuquerque.
I do, too. You know, it's a weird place now. And it got a little beat up, but I love it.
Yeah, the whole country got beat up, man.
That's for sure. It's still being
beat up. How about now?
It's still being beat up.
Yeah. How about the way things are now? The live music business is destroyed. Half the clubs won't come back. They're going to go bankrupt.
Right.
They can't take off 3 months.
Yeah.
These little places.
Yeah.
You know, the bigger places. Yeah. You know, City Winery will still be there. But the little places.
The joints.
A lot of them won't be able to come back. And it's terrible. And it's going to have an effect for years.
On music.
Yep.
Fucking sad, and we're in the middle of it.
Really is.
We don't even see. I don't see how we get out of it. We're still in the fucking tunnel here.
We're still in the middle of it, and nobody knows.
So, well, this record that you did with Leroy Bell is a pretty powerful record. It's sort of a socially and politically relevant record. These are songs
I'm
written.
Glad that you hear that. I'm very glad that you hear that.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know, these are songs written, you know, to the moment that we're living in now in a lot of ways.
Yep.
And, you know, there's an intensity to it, an honesty to it. He's a hell of a singer. How did this record come about?
My wife, Taylor Barton, heard some of Leroy's songs.
Uh-huh.
About a year and a half ago now. Maybe 2 years ago, she heard the stuff. And then in January of 2019, we got a hold of Leroy and invited him to come here to the house and sit. And I've been looking for a singer for 30 years.
Well, you've done a few records, but not that many, right? Solo records.
Yeah, he's done some records.
What about you?
He writes great songs.
How many solo records you do?
I did a few solo records. I don't know. Two or three. I don't remember.
I listened to the first one. It's sort of the kind of punky one.
Oh, that one. Yeah. In the World.
Yeah. In
that
the World.
In 1980.
Yeah. Yeah.
1980.
Yeah.
So anyway, Leroy came to the house and we sat down and he had just written that song, America.
Yeah.
That's on the record. And I just loved it. You know, I said, well, yeah. Okay. And we started playing it and the way I played and the way he sang it, it just fit together. You know, it was just one of those things. It was exactly what I had been looking for all those years. So we started recording right away. A friend of mine has a recording studio right near here.
Uh-huh.
We went over and right away started making some music. And we wound up getting this deal with BMG And the record was going to be released at South by Southwest in March, but of course that got canceled.
Right.
You know, again, this whole thing with the virus closing everything down.
Yeah.
Now, fortunately, here the digital world will work in our favor, that we will be able to get the record out in front of people.
Uh-huh.
We've made a video already for America. There was just talk starting around today, doing another video for one of the other songs. But yeah, we Leroy just writes that stuff that it is political and it is saying something, but he doesn't slap you in the face with it. You
know? Yeah, yeah. No, I like the also that song Codeine.
Codeine, yeah, that's, I've always played that song. I always loved that song. When I was back in the folk scare,
yeah,
I saw Buffy St. Marie play that song. Probably in 1962 or something.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I always loved that song. I've always performed it. You know, so I was glad to be able to get that on record.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, that kind of folk groove played, you know, with that, you know, with your, you know, with your electric guitar. It's got, yeah, like, it's great. Like, you don't, I, you know, it's familiar, but you don't hear it a lot anymore. And it just, it sounds great. And that's a song about drugs, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a song about codeine. Yeah. Codeine. Yep.
And so, you know, that always, you know, is kind of an evergreen topic. But who the fuck, who's playing drums, dude?
Yeah, right.
Who is that?
Now on Codeine, I believe that's Josh Dion, who is a great drummer, lives in Brooklyn, and he's kind of like a really happening guy right now. And I was lucky I met him and got him to come and play on. So Josh plays on a bunch of stuff. Sean Pelton plays on some of the songs. On America, it's both Josh and Sean.
Yeah. Good drum, you know, sound on that record. Guitar sound, yeah, great.
Thanks. Yeah, I thought that we did wind up getting some good sounds.
Yeah, man. So, well, I mean, I wish you all the luck with that. And also, like, so now you're still only, you got to have a 59 Les Paul, no?
I sold the last one I had. I've had a bunch of them over the years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You
know?
Yeah.
After a while, you know, I just wasn't ever playing a Les Paul.
Oh, really? Anymore. That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had kind of like, you know, worn that out. I still have a couple, you know, but not a 59 Sunburst. You know?
Oh, no. Oh, right. Right.
54 Junior.
Oh, yeah.
1954 Junior. One of the first ones that is magic. I saw it on eBay about 10 years ago. I saw the picture of it and I went, that's really primitive. You know, look at that. The finish is weird. Everything about it's weird. And it's just a magical guitar.
Oh,
really good.
That's a great looking guitar. I can picture it. Yeah. With the one pickup, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like yours.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The single cutaway and the Sunburst finish. But I always play my Telecaster, you know.
Yeah.
But the guitar that I did a lot of this record with, the Stony Hill record, is a 1962 Epiphone Sheraton.
Huh.
Like, wait, I got it right here. I'll show it to you.
Oh, yeah. That's beautiful.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is a 62.
Yeah.
And again, I saw this on eBay.
No kidding.
Like about 6-8 years ago. And I could tell. I've had Sheratons before. I've had other 62s. I had a blonde 62. But this one, I could tell something about it was magical.
Huh.
And it is. It's a either somebody worked, you know, at this point, Gibson was making Epiphones.
Yeah.
By 1952. 58, they started. They bought Epiphone. And this guitar was either made by an employee or was a custom order or something, because it's got a lot of unusual things. It's a little bit wider at the nut. You know, the fingerboard's a little wider. Uh-huh. And I got big, big palms.
Well, man, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, like, I remember a while back you got some flack for playing at the Republican convention. That must have sucked.
Well, it was it doesn't bother me. You know, you're always going to, like, when I was on Saturday Night Live, I would get fan mail, you know?
Yeah.
And if I got 1,000 letters, you know, 900 of them would really like me and 100 of them would hate me.
Yeah.
Hate me. There were people that hated me. You know, if you go out in the public, that's going to happen. So here's my thing about playing the Republican convention. I'm not a Republican.
Yeah.
I do not support Donald Trump. Right. I don't like Donald Trump. I think he's done a lot of really ugly things.
Yeah.
I think his subtle approval of this white nationalism thing is just horrible.
Yeah.
And has set this country back 100 years.
Yeah.
That's what America's about.
Yeah.
That's what that song America's about.
Right. Yeah.
Is that attitude, you know?
So it's just a gig. You got offered a gig.
It was just a gig. Yeah. I played at the 2012 Republican convention for Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
And he didn't win, right?
Yeah.
I don't care. I played at mafia weddings.
Yeah.
Right? They were great gigs. They paid a lot. They were nice. The food was good.
Right.
They were nice people.
No, I hear you. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if they were nice all the time, but they were nice to me.
I think we can we could probably bank on them not being nice all the time.
Probably not, you know.
No, I get it. Yeah.
The Republican convention, I'm a New York City guy, right? I lived in New York City for 40 years.
Yeah.
Trump, before he got to be president, right? All those years before, he was a joke in New York City. Nobody took him seriously. In July of 2016, when I played at that thing,
yeah,
he wasn't going to win.
Yeah.
Everybody thought, no, Hillary.
Yeah.
Hillary's in.
Yeah.
You know, it's gonna happen. The first night at that convention, when he was introduced and he came out in the rock and roll smoke,
right?
You know,
yeah,
it looked like a Poison show or Motley Crue show, something,
right?
Know? And I looked at Jeff, the keyboard player, and he looked at me, and Jeff said, "He's gonna win." Yeah. We went, "Yeah."
Oh shit, man! So the crowd went crazy.
The crowd went crazy.
And here we are. Here we are. Hold up. Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
no, I'm not a political person. You know?
Yeah, you just took a gig.
It was a gig. It paid a lot.
Okay.
You know, I got to pay all my guys, give them a real good payday for 3 or 4 days work. And I took home a bunch of money, you know. But I never, ever thought when I first got the gig and took I never thought he was going to win.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And I wouldn't, now that I know where the guy's really at, I would never do it again.
Sure. Yeah. No, you're not going to play Trump's party. Yeah.
No.
Well, that's good. Well, man, I wish you great luck with this record. And it was certainly great talking to you. I love talking about music.
Mark.
And, you know, and take care of yourself, man.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. That was GE and me talking guitars and whatnot. The new album coming out in August is called Stony Hill. It's a collaboration with the soul singer Leroy Bell. Let's play some guitar.
Kramer lives.